Welcome to Sensible Health Solutions, the show where we simplify health and wellness. Join your hosts, Haley Fields and Dr. Scott Looper, as they share practical tips and expert insight to help you navigate common ailments, nutrition, and overall well-being. Tune in for straightforward advice that empowers you to live a healthier life.
Hi, Haley.
Good morning, Dr. Looper. How are you?
Good. Doing good. Tip top. Sun's coming back here in Fairbanks, which is lovely.
I know. I was leaving work yesterday, and it was still dusk. And coming into work today, we have daylight.
Yeah, it's always nice. It's the changes in the air.
Yeah. You know?
The seasons are very, very strong here in Alaska. And, you know, it's amazing the differences from month to month, not to mention from, you know, season to season. So I got me thinking about symptoms. Now, I'm not saying there's a strong connection between the seasons and symptoms. They both start with the letter S. That's probably about as close as it goes. But it got me thinking about symptoms and how we have a different view of symptoms here in this clinic than most people do. Symptoms usually are the problem. That's right. They're listed as the problem, and the solution is figuring out a way to get rid of the symptoms. And for us, the symptoms are really more often the solution.
Yeah.
Nature's solution to the problem.
Right. Your symptoms are kind of like your body trying to heal and fix itself.
Yeah. So I want to go over this a little bit and talk about an example that we're all familiar with, which is fever. And also, by the way, I have something in my eye, so I'm going to have to rub my eye a lot while I'm talking. But fever. Back in the day, fever was a clear sign of you sick. You got a fever, you were sick, right? And so then they invented this. Actually, let's talk about what fever does. Reason why you'd get a fever, what the utility of a fever is. When you get a fever, your immune system works way better. Not twice as good, not three times as good, about 10 times as good. It's almost like a switch is flipped. Because when you're at a normal temperature, your immune system is quiescent. That means it just kind of sits there and waits. It does a little bit of work, a little bit of side action, but nothing major. And then if you get some sort of infection and it really needs to kick into gear, then one of the ways your body triggers this is like, okay, everybody, focus. We're going to do this thing. It cranks the temperature up. You get a fever, and then suddenly everybody's going at it, hammer and tongs, fixing like crazy, fighting, doing whatever your body needs to do to get over the infection. And you're miserable. You don't want to do anything. You don't want to get up. You just want to lay and feel horrible. And so that's really turns out to be a beneficial thing because you're not using any energy to do anything else other than get better.
Right.
Now, back in the late 1800s, they invented this drug called aspirin. Kind of reinvented because aspirin had already been around. Salicylic acid, which is what aspirin is, was around in the form of willow bark. Willow bark. Bark had been known since caveman days. If you chew willow bark, it tends to knock fever down. It blocks some of the mechanism that triggers the fever. So fever comes down, you feel better, problem solved. And so once aspirin was invented, I mean, people started using it, and it was self-evident how helpful it was. And really, when I grew up, there still was this feeling in kind of society as a whole that fever was a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got a fever, you were sick, you should take something.
Right.
Knock the fever down.
Yeah.
You know, there was ads on TV. You know, you got
Tylenol.
Well, you know, they invented newer things to knock fever down because the aspirin turned out to have a nasty side effect of putting holes in people's stomachs.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't necessarily, you know, kill everybody who takes it. I mean, because then, you know, no one would ever take it. But if you took enough of it over a long enough period of time, you'd get some kind of gastritis from it. Or if you took really high levels of it, it'd damage your kidneys, it could damage your ears, it could cause you to bleed too much. There was a bunch of side effects with it that you're using too much. So they came up with alternatives to dial down the side effects. But aspirin still is used today. It's still effective. It's something that you could take to knock down pain and fever. Fever comes down as well. Now, one of the things, it took a while for us to figure this out, but once we got rid of fever, it turned out that our immune systems didn't work as well. Yeah, duh. Of course. But here's the thing about immune systems. They have a lot of excess capacity. You could shut a part of them down, and they still have plenty of, you know, bandwidth to be able to fight off the infection, and people would survive. So you knock the fever down, you feel better, and you still get better.
Uh-huh.
Unless you needed every scrap of bandwidth that you had. And then, so some conditions are more serious, more life-threatening than other conditions, like COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Or back in the day, back in the early 20th century, the Spanish flu, so-called Spanish flu. It actually didn't come from Spain, but that's another story. The Spanish flu, which killed millions of people. Now, it's speculated, and we'll never know for sure because we can't go back and do the research, but it's speculated that one of the reasons why the Spanish flu was so deadly is because they had recently, you know, within a few decades, and invented aspirin. You know, it was widely available. And so people took aspirin to combat the fever. They decreased the effectiveness of the immune system slightly.
Sure.
Maybe more than slight, significantly.
Okay.
And so people died. They needed that extra that they got from the fever. And then they all got, not all of them died. Other ones got, you know, brain damage or other problems from the way the virus affected them. They had all kinds of side effects. Same story with COVID. It's not like everybody gets COVID, either die or live. There's all kinds of people who live, and yet they have these long-term sequelae from the COVID. It's always the same story with these things. Okay, so fever is helpful. When we shut fever down, we feel better. People live anyways, except for some people die because they needed that fever. And so now, years later, you know, 100 years later, we figured this out. And now it's commonly known. You should not shut down a fever. If you go to the doctor now, the doctors say, no, you need a fever.
Well, in, you know, infants and young children, what I know is that you need to keep the fever down. So you do need to give them medication. Is that the same instance for adults? And if it is a health risk to let that fever spike, then...
It is. There is a health risk. So if a fever gets above 103 in infants, that's a high fever. And then they got a chance of getting seizures.
Yep.
Not every kid with a 103 fever will get a seizure, but some do. Enough to where you should keep it below 103. Now, should you keep it, what, to 98.6 or 99? No. What you really want to do is you want to let it run 102, 101, somewhere around there. And that's where you're going to get your best effects because it's a safe fever, and yet it's fever enough that it stimulates your immune system so that it'll fight off the infection better. And so that's the happy zone. So where we're at right now is, thank goodness we have brains. It doesn't. We don't have to just let this thing run automatically because automatically you can either run too low or too high, and will. Mm-hmm. Not to say always. Most of the time it'll dial in just perfectly, but it has the potential of, you know, the system itself is self-regulating, and sometimes it's not sentient, right? It's
right.
Not like there's a computer in our head that runs things, right? It's more just reflex, and sometimes reflex doesn't do it right, and you get these side effects. I mean, you can actually get a fever high enough above about 105. You can actually get brain damage. I mean, you literally can take some serious damage from the fever because when you get hot enough, it starts breaking your cells down. So there's a limit to how much fever we should have. And as human beings and doctors especially, we should be aware of this, the fever, keep an eye on it, and then dial it down appropriately so that you get the maximum benefit, the minimum downside to it. And that's where we're at on this right now, which is the symptom is useful. The utility of the symptom has been well recognized, commonly understood. Now, I'm not saying there isn't people in the world who still think fever is the enemy and they take something for it. But those people are becoming less and less common, more and more common, particularly in the leaders of society in terms of health, otherwise doctors, nurses, and other practitioners, know that fever is useful. Okay? So we're getting this consciousness change about symptoms. Okay? We're good on that, right?
Okay.
We talked about fever.
Right.
Okay, now let's talk about depression. It's the same.
Interesting.
Yeah, you wouldn't think. You think, well, depression's bad. I mean, what good is there in depression? You know, depression was this horrible, debilitating thing, and then people just suffered with it until in the 90s, late 80s, they invented these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, became commonly available in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And that basically knocked depression down. You take a pill and you feel better.
Uh-huh.
And this is great. I mean, what's wrong with that? Just like the betterment of society. Nope. It's the same story again that we got with fever. Turns out that the depression, even though it's uncomfortable, has a utility. That there is a benefit that comes from depression. Yeah, you look at me like I'm crazy.
Benefit.
Okay. Now let's think for a second. Feelings. Yeah. Why the heck do we have feelings? What possible use could feelings be? I mean, my brain does math fine without feelings. I could wash the dishes without feelings. I can mow the lawn without feelings. I mean, what the heck is these feelings here? I mean, all they do is torture me.
Right. Exactly. Right?
Yeah, feelings are horrible. I mean, yeah. I'd rather not have them. Except for, no, turns out they're useful. The unpleasantness, a lot of time, correlates to the usefulness of the feelings. So the thing with feelings is your brain, sussing, whatever the word is, where you scan the environment and you put together patterns, and then you recognize something's not right, and then your brain, in its wisdom, presents that something is not right to you, and you get this feeling. Sometimes it's subtle, and sometimes it's the opposite of subtle. It's in your face. The degree of intensity associated with degree that your body, your brain in particular, thinks, hey, this is an important thing for you to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Okay, let me give you a simple example. You're going along, and it's dark, and you're in the forest, and you hear a twig crack, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you're washed over with anxiety. Why?
Because you're alone in the woods.
Because there's danger.
Yeah, there's a threat.
Your brain, right. In its wisdom, all on its own, mind you. Not that you're doing anything. It did this completely independent of you. Assessed there's a danger here. There's something about the smell in the air. Or you read that thing in the book, right? Or maybe it happened to you 3 years ago and you were in a similar situation. And your body goes, wow, this is the same thing we did before. Click. Boom. You get a feeling. And that feeling is fear. Now, if it's slight, we don't call it fear. We call it apprehension. We call it worry. We call it anxiety. We call it dread, maybe. There's some kind of like subtlety to it, or not so subtle. All the way, we could progress all the way to sheer terror. And again, what our brain is doing is saying, there's danger. I'm sorry, I have the danger, Will Robinson. I saw Lost in Space recently, so that comes into my head, right? Yeah, like that. Danger, there's danger.
Right.
And so your body, you know, becomes more alert. Your blood sugars go up, your blood pressure goes up, your body takes blood from your digestive system and puts it towards your muscles and your brain and your heart, and so you're in better shape to be able to survive. You're awake, you're alert, you're engaged, your chance of survival just went up.
Right.
Right, so there's a utility in this fear thing.
So what's the utility with depression? Because to my understanding, depression isn't a motivating emotion. It depresses you.
No, it is.
It makes you feel like you're incapable.
No, that it can be. Now, fear is also a demotivating feeling in the right situation. There are people who collapse under fear. They become incapable of taking action, right? That's a possibility.
Oh,
it either motivates you to work or it shuts you down.
Fawn or freeze,
Yeah, right? Same thing with all the emotions. So you can get depression bad enough where it shuts you down, you can't take any action. But that's unusual. Most of the time what happens when you feel sadness, let's just call it depression, let's call it sadness. When you feel sadness, there is a motivating factor there because there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just ask you, what's the, you know, there's information contained in the feeling, whatever the feeling is. If you ask yourself, why am I feeling this? A lot of times it'll bubble up, the actual thing that you're afraid of.
Yeah.
It's because I heard that crack and there's a smell in the air of some kind of danger. Or it with sadness, it's not so obvious what that information might be, but there is information there. In fact, let me just ask you, you got an idea what that might be? What basic information does sadness contain?
Some sort of unhappiness. You're unhappy with...
No, wait. Simpler than that. Something is missing.
Right.
That's the information. Something that should be there isn't. It's an absence of something that should be there. So my dog is missing. My dog died. Now I feel sad. I feel the absence of my dog. Right?
Right.
My favorite knife got lost in the woods, and now I wish I had it, and you feel sad over the loss. I mean, I'm picking a bonehead thing here, but normally it's some kind of, you know, relationship.
I need something, yeah, bigger.
Yeah, but there's a missing. That's what sadness basically is. There's a missing.
Yeah.
The bigger picture.
Or an anger that things aren't the way that you want them to be.
Well, that's another feeling. And that's another. Anger is different. Anger is not something's missing. Anger is something is wrong. Something is unjust. Something is out of place. There's a relationship between all three of those statements.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically something is wrong,
right,
and I don't like it, and so you feel anger. So anger's another category. Fear is another category, too, and you can make an argument that fear underlies all the other emotions, but you got to stretch pretty hard to really
connect it. Yeah, isn't that what Yoda said?
Something like that, right? I mean, if you really get super deep and super philosophical, in a more of a practical way, fear is something's threatening you, anger is something's out of place or wrong, and sadness is something's missing. It's serious. When you go through your life and you feel sadness, next time you feel sadness, you don't take my word for it. Just stop for a second and ask, why do I feel this way? And what will happen is it'll come up. You'll think, something's missing. You know, I feel sad because I wish I was with my family at Christmas.
Right.
Right? Or my friend moved away.
Mm-hmm.
But again, something's missing. Fill in the blank. Something's missing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now what happens with that feeling? Typically what happens is you think, I need a new friend. I'm going to get in a plane and fly and go be with my family. Talk about motivating. It's highly motivating.
Right.
Yeah. Usually the severity of the feeling is the degree to which the motivation happens. Now, where it becomes unmotivating is when there's no solution. You're in misery and you see no way out, and then you decided to collapse. Now, that's definitely a breakdown. So that's looking at as a symptom, like fever. Is there a utility in fever? Yes, it helps your immune system work better. Is there a utility in the symptom of sadness? Yes, it motivates you to correct a problem, to go out and find another one, to engage, to do this thing where you're mixing it up, right? In life, and you're motivated to go out and take chances, to go to the dance, you know, and stand there and find somebody to dance with, right?
Yep.
Where does that motivation come from?
Uh-huh.
A lot of times because something's missing. You know, there's a thing, I'm going to go out and do something to fix this situation.
Mm-hmm.
I pick dance because that's like the most horrific thing I could think of.
Yeah, we don't do dances in Fairbanks, Alaska really either. So, but
They do exist. They're not that popular.
No.
And it turns out depression is rampant.
Yeah.
And people are isolated in their lives.
Yeah, people are isolated. I think that's the biggest thing that depression is causing depression, and this facade that our devices are creating this connection. It's not the type of connection human needs. We need actually in-person
pseudo connection. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's less than what you're looking for. It's a connection, so it's better than nothing, but it's not what you want. There still is this missing, and so you feel the missing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There it is.
And so it makes you sadder because it's not the actual real connection that you need. You need to be in person. You need to be able to read micro movements in another person's face, or read their body language, or feel their warmth, or feel their energy.
Pheromones, right? There's a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
All kinds of things that go. There's a humanity and touch, right?
Right.
That comes.
Yeah.
You know, and physical presence.
So I know we've talked about fever before being the solution to symptoms, but I hadn't thought about it for depression.
Yeah, same thing. Seriously, we could look at nearly every symptom that there is and play the same thing out. What is the utility of the symptom? Turns out there is a utility. In fact, I'm gonna push on this sadness thing a little bit more, and then let's do the show again. We're gonna do it with something else. I'll let you pick a symptom or something. So let's go through the sadness thing. Okay, so you feel sadness. You know, in the old days, you just had to figure out, bootstrap your way out of it. You had to take action or do something.
Did they prescribe you alcohol when you were sad?
You could drink alcohol. Yeah, there's another thing. You could drink alcohol, and that'll numb the feeling for sure.
Right.
And then, unfortunately, at some point, you sober up, and now you're back with your feelings more so than they were before. I mean, certainly, people have tried this as a strategy, and in the short term, it works. It's useful. If it didn't work, people wouldn't do it. It's just as a long-term strategy, it fails. Now, SSRIs are the same. What happens is, in the short term, they work. In the long term, they fail. Now, I'm sorry to have to tell people who are listening here, especially lots of people who aren't SSRIs, but they quit working usually around year 2, 3. I mean, that's a long time. That's a long time that you're getting benefit from it. A long time that sadness is dialed down and you're feeling better, because there's a mechanism to the sadness. Serotonin has a lot to do with our mood. It's not the only thing, but it's a thing. And if serotonin levels are up, we feel good. We feel confident. We feel, you know, we feel better. And if serotonin levels are low and we feel sensitive and we feel sad and we're overwhelmed easily and where our courage goes down, and there's a bunch of stuff that breaks down with the low serotonin. So if you can figure out a way to get serotonin levels up that's real, then you feel better. Mostly what it turns out to be is take action. Go put yourself in situations where you can triumph. And boy, serotonin comes in thick.
Right.
You go to the dance and you become the most popular person at the dance. You're a dance god, right? Woohoo, I feel good, right? Let's do this again. I mean, I don't know. That's an extreme example there. But
right.
Serotonin's going to be flowing, you know, freely.
Big time.
Right. So now if you take a SSRI, which is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, what you're doing is you're blocking the reuptake of serotonin. Normally, we put serotonin out and then we pull it back in. And this one, you put serotonin out and it's blocked. And so now it's out where it's doing its thing. And so you feel better because you got more serotonin out there. But there's more serotonin, except for there isn't more serotonin. There's the same amount of serotonin. It's just that it's out rather than in.
Yeah.
In the short run, you're going to feel good about this. But eventually, it disrupts the recycling of serotonin. And you, in fact, eventually come up short. Because
you
since you can't reabsorb it, all you can do is make it. And the system's really not designed for you making it new every time you need it. And it doesn't shut it down completely. It inhibits it. It doesn't block it. So there's some reuptake. But it alters the chemistry such that eventually it doesn't work anymore. The system should break down. Now, what doctors do, they know this. What they do is they'll up the dose. And that'll work for a while, maybe, mostly. And then it quits working. And then what they'll do is they'll switch you to a new one. And that'll change things up enough that it changes the mechanism. And that'll work, maybe, less so, actually. The chance of it working is not quite as much. And then eventually they run out. They've upped the dose as much as they can. They've reused, or they've tried to change around and use the meds as best they can, and eventually it just does nothing. Most people take them because they still feel bad, and they're trying to feel better, but it's in fact doing nothing. Except if you quit taking it, then your mood plummets, rockets down, and so you're highly motivated to take it, even though it's not getting rid of the depression. You're still depressed.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. As a long-term strategy, it doesn't work. Now, as a short-term strategy, it does work because it can take the edge off. If you're one of those people that's overwhelmed with sadness where you are shut down, you literally can't do your life. You can't work or you can't be in relationship with somebody. Holy moly, we got to do something to lighten this thing up so you can go out and do something to get a life as a temporary measure, and then we wean you off it. That's the best use of it. Now, remember, this is the same thing we said with aspirin or Tylenol. Or Advil, or naproxen, or whatever it is, the thing we're doing, the fever breaker. So what we're going to do is we're going to use a little bit, a low dose, as a way to regulate the intensity of the symptom so that there's no damage taken from it. We're going to use our brains, we're going to be intelligent, and we're going to use this tool that we have, and we're going to live better lives because we're smart. Okay, that's how to do it. That's the best use. Now, if you don't use anything and then nature just has to take its course, maybe you're lucky, maybe you're not. No. I got a brain. I'd rather use my brain. And so I'll know to suffer fever until my fever gets above 103. And then, first of all, I got to figure out what the heck I have the fever for. So, you know, I have to go to the doctor and all that stuff. But once if I understand it all, I just need to dial it down off of the 105 to save my brain. Mm-hmm. And then engage other common sense solutions like take antibiotics or whatever it is to go to solve this thing. Same story with the depression. So you got the feeling. If the feeling is moderate, just do stuff. Just take action. Don't take anything.
Okay? Exercise.
Exercise. There's lots of ways to get your serotonin levels to go up. In fact, let me just mention one of them right now. Serotonin is made out of tryptophan. Tryptophan has to get converted into 5-hydroxytryptophan. That, in turn, is converted into serotonin. That, in turn, is converted into melatonin. So there's a whole series of these things. So you can take tryptophan, and eventually it'll get converted into serotonin. It's kind of slow, doesn't work that well. I mean, it's okay, it's decent, it's a decent thing to do. But if you want to get it quicker, better, faster, what you do is save a step,
mm-hmm.
take the 5-hydroxytryptophan, which you can pick up at the grocery store.
It's the 5-HTP.
5-HTP, right. So it's a non-prescription, normal thing that you can take. And the dose is usually around 50 milligrams, maybe once or twice a day, something like that. Some kind of low dose thing. And then you just got to encourage the conversion of the 5-hydroxytryptophan, 5-HTP, into serotonin, and that's where the exercise comes in.
Okay.
If you jump around, walk around, do stuff, it gets your blood flowing, and your body needs the serotonin, and so boop, you do the conversion. It's nice because you're not forcing the issue; you're just allowing nature take its course. You're just greasing the skids of this whole process. So the results are good, and then it doesn't take long for you to feel better. The average time it takes to do the conversion from 5-HTP into serotonin is about 45 minutes.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not like you can wait an hour, you're already feeling better.
Okay.
So it's not like a long term thing. You have to wait weeks and weeks to feel better. You feel better right away. And then the other thing I want to mention is the SSRIs do have a danger associated with them. They the high dose or certain ones are particularly effective. They really seriously block serotonin from being reuptaken. And so they keep serotonin in the middle. And what you get is a paradoxical effect where instead of your mood going up, your mood plummets.
Mm.
Now, your mood goes up a bit, but if you take too much, it doesn't go down a bit. It goes down a lot. It plummets like a rock. And you're more likely to want to commit suicide at that point.
Right.
And so when they first started using the SSRIs, they found that teenagers were prone to suicide by taking them. And they thought, what is the dealio with teenagers? It turns out teenagers just had an altered metabolism because they're young, and they couldn't handle the dosage, and they had an exaggerated response to the normal dose. They were getting normal dose, but they're having an exaggerated response because they're teenagers, and many of them were killing themselves. What they eventually figured out is, you know, first of all, don't use the stuff. Try other means to help people. Or if you are going to use it, then use a lower dose, and then you can get a better effect that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a hiccup that got, I mean, if you're dead, it's not a hiccup, but, you know, as society's concerned, it wasn't like we wanted to throw these things away. They're useful. We just have to realize there's certain situations we've got to change the dosage on.
Right.
So really, I don't know how much time we have, but we've
got 2 minutes.
Okay, so let me summarize. So the summary is symptoms. Symptoms have a utility. When you have a symptom, the reason why you have the symptom, it's your body trying to fix a thing. That's what the symptom is. And so it's easy to look at that symptom and say, that's why I'm broken. I have fever. That's why I'm broken. No, your fever is not the thing. It's because you have an infection. The infection is why you're sick. But the infection doesn't want to cause a fuss. They just want to take over your body and eat. And so your body says, wow, we got a problem here. Alarms go off. The whole mechanism turns on. And now you got a fever. The fever is the solution to the problem. It's not the problem. It's the solution to the problem. Okay, let's talk about sadness. You think, oh, I feel sad. This is horrible. I hate this. No, the sadness is not the problem. The sadness is the solution to the problem. The sadness is that thing that lets you know there is a problem, because otherwise you wouldn't know.
It motivates you to change it.
And it motivates you to change it.
In some cases.
In most cases. In most cases. Now, it's unpleasant, like fever. I mean, fever could kill you. Dr. Looper, fever could kill you. We need
right.
to shut those down.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. There's these odd ones, and they're the one-offs that are weird, and those ones can kill you. But we don't throw the whole group of benefit away because we get some weird examples over here. No, generally, this turns out to be a beneficial thing. And some people get sad and say, kill themselves. We need to fix this. You're right. There's extreme examples. But the vast majority of people with sadness, they get another dog.
Doesn't mean you want to shut it down completely or avoid it completely.
No, keep flowing with this thing. What you need to do is when the symptom comes, ask yourself the question, why? Why am I getting this symptom? And then a lot of times what you'll get an answer. Your brain and its wisdoms will pop something up. Or you'll think, oh, yeah, I know this happened before, right? I'm getting this because of, right, whatever the thing is. You know, and with sadness, the feeling is, I mean, the basic information is something's missing. Now, it could be something obvious. You know, my goldfish died and I feel sad, right? Or it could be that I have no friends. I moved to a new city. I thought it was going to be great here. I got this new job. It's been 6 months in this new city. I am isolated. I am depressed. I call my friend on the phone and they're like, you know, I'm busy, I'm sorry, I got this thing I'm doing. And now I'm isolated and I feel like, I feel horrible. Okay, so what do you do? Clearly, you go get a pill.
Yeah.
No, you don't. What you do is you think about how to work the problem, how to do things. I mean, heaven forbid, maybe you end up at a dance somewhere, right? Or whatever, maybe bowling or at the model airplane club. You do something that's appropriate. Here's an idea. go sit with a counselor.
Yep.
Run the ideas back with them, and they'll say, you know, I've seen this back in '04, and you know, it turns out the guy, he liked to build airplanes, and we got him in this club. Now he's happy as clam.
Yeah.
He's got too many friends.
And exercise. You need to exercise.
Oh yeah, and the
too.
Exercise thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Dr. Looper, I think that's all the time we have today. We'll pick it up next time and talk about more symptoms.
All right, sounds great.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Sensible Health Solutions. We hope you found today's discussion enlightening and packed with practical tips to enhance your wellness journey. Remember, small changes can lead to big results. If you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us bring you the best content possible. Stay connected with us on social media for more health insights and updates. You can find us at Sensible Health Solutions across all social platforms. Until next time, stay sensible and stay healthy. This content is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Seek medical advice from a healthcare professional for any medical conditions.